from the Crypt.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. We're on to recording number 2 on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon in March. Middle of March. Approaching March Madness. Sitting down for the second time today with a very exciting guest. I'm excited to speak to him, at least.
Hi.
Well, you just heard him. I want to introduce you freaks to Carl Don. Carl, welcome to the podcast.
Hey. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming. For you freaks that don't know, Carl is working at Chain Code Labs right now. I was first introduced to you, I think, last month at the BitDevs meetup when...
Yep. I did the presentation and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a dope presentation. We'll get into that later.
Thank you.
Let's dive into your story. It seems like you have an interesting one. How the hell did you find Bitcoin? What is your tale? How did you end up here working on Rust Bitcoin?
Oh boy. I first heard about it when one of my high school teachers told me about it, because he was like our, you know, science research program head, and he was like, hey, like, you know, there's this thing that's really cool. And so because I was living in a dorm back then, I really liked building computers. I built a bunch of computers because I didn't want to study for my exams, and mined Dogecoin. So that
not
tells
the first
you,
Doge,
yeah, yeah,
not the first Dogecoin miner on this podcast.
No, no. Yeah, well, Dogecoin was very profitable for a while. I mean, like, I did the thing where I think you can mine Dogecoin and then sell it immediately for Bitcoin. So like, there were pools that did that. But yeah, I was not profitable, let's just say that. It was just me messing around with stuff and, you know. So that was really cool. I forgot about it for a little bit. And then when I was, like, looking into, like, what work I can do during college, I stumbled upon, 21, and I went work for 21, and that was a good experience. I met a bunch of people there. I met Michael Goldstein, who's really cool. And he sort of, and back then, I mean, like, I didn't know anything about anything. So I was like, oh, have you checked out, all these other coins and like the way they do stuff and like, their marketing propaganda?
Did he turn to you, look you in the eyes and say, Carl, everyone's a scammer?
Exactly. Yes. That was basically the message that I was given. But yeah, anyways, it prompted me to look deeper into all these things. I was becoming more well-versed with computer science, so I was able to look at their code base, and then I was more well-versed with, Unix systems and whatever, and I would look at, how this would work in that kind of sense. And then senior year of college, went to Blockstream and worked, and that was, like, a great experience that, because everybody who's the best were there, so... Most people that were the best that worked there, and I was able to learn from them. They were really patient and explaining to me how everything worked. Now I'm at Chain Code working on cool shit.
Yeah, so it seems like Bitcoin from a technical aspect is what drew you in. Is there anything like philosophically, like economically, or sort of freedom? Liberty driven that brought you to Bitcoin, or is it more like working on this distributed system in particular?
Okay. I'm a Chinese citizen, so mm-hmm. This is a public podcast, so we'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. That's all you have to say. Let's go back to 21. What was it like? I was telling you, I got my 21 computer upstairs. I would like to bring it down and show you.
Yeah. I bought one of those as well before I, even started there, and I was a little bit confused as to, what they were doing, but, as I got there, it seemed like they were transitioning off it, and, I think what we built, and I think Balaji showed it in Consensus 2016 or something, I thought that was pretty cool. So there's like, when you make an HTTP request to a website, right, like mm-hmm. it'll give you back a status code, right? And and that status code tells you if it's successful or it fails or whatever, right? But one of those status codes were payment required. So nobody implemented that because, there was no way to do it programmatically yet, right? But you know, we basically implemented a command line tool that was able to, like, you know, charge people for paying for an endpoint that will say, hey, payment required, and then you do the back and forth.
And this, I've given this error request a misnomer in the past. Is it 402 or 403, the error that comes up, or 405? Isn't it like, so you have 404 error?
Yeah. 404 is not, like, not found. I think, I seriously don't remember. But anyways, we were doing that, and I thought it was a really cool thing that we were doing.
I thought it was really cool at the time too. It's interesting to see. So I guess this is an interesting topic we can get jumped into, considering that experience in particular, because that, I remember being like, oh my God, I'm going to get my home miner. I'm going to, like, be part of the machine payable web. I'm going to learn how to, like, use Bitcoin in the command line, and a lot of hard lessons learned.
For sure.
Wasn't the most profitable miner. I don't think it was profitable
for me. No.
But,
for sure not.
What were some of the lessons you learned there in particular?
Well, I wasn't really involved with the, 21 little computer part, right? Like, but by the time I got there, we were working on machine payable web, and that was mostly like, hey, let's use containers on normal computers, like, you know, Macs and Linuxes and whatever to do all of those things, right? And I think one of the things that I learned there is that, like, and perhaps they did not continue with this philosophy afterwards, is that you don't need a different coin to do things that are very smart, right? You sometimes, if you want a certain type of functionality and it's going to come from something centralized anyways, or, you know, if you have a, like, service discovery mechanism, then you can just implement it through HTTP and just any odd coin, right? Like, you separate the function of, like, what's going to be running a certain piece of software versus, like, the payment of it, right? And so I really like that philosophy. It didn't complicate things, and it seems to mesh well with, you know, the Unix philosophy of, like, you know, make small tools that do things well and, you know, put them together.
Yeah. Now, that's one thing that fascinates me about Bitcoin development in particular, especially after the first conversation I ever had with a guest in this podcast was with Pierre Rochard, and he explained the Unix philosophy to me, and I think after becoming more abreast to that philosophy and sort of the history of Unix build out and Linux eventually, it just seems like Bitcoin may be the only project displaying these types of attributes from a developer standpoint.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if Pierre told you the story, and I might tell it badly, but it's an illustrative story of,
I don't think he did. Let's jump into it.
So you know, one of the most illustrative stories of this Unix philosophy is when I think two programmers I can't remember their names, and I feel so bad for this. It's the guy who wrote the algorithm books, Donald Knuth, I think, and another Unix programmer, but, you know, this was way back in the days. They were given this challenge that was like, okay, like, given this text file, like, sort it, add these columns together and do what, basically, like, spreadsheet like things, right? And, you know, back then you didn't have Excel, so it was, like, hard to do. And so what Donald Knuth did was he wrote this entire what he calls literate programming language and, like, implemented it and was like, it was like, oh, this is so beautiful because it's, like, in my own literate programming language, it's so readable and whatever, right? And, like, I think, you know, the Unix program was just like, he just, like, gave us one liner that combined, like, five commands, and it was like, what, like 80 characters, and was like, done.
We did, right? Not need that
literate. We did not need all that. You know, we can piece things together to make extremely complex interactions.
And that's, so I guess let's jump into the philosophy behind Bitcoin Core and developing on top of Bitcoin, I guess, because I mean, that's the big, it's not really a big debate, but it's a big sort of divide with Bitcoin and other projects. Other projects would think that fast iteration and fast experimentation is worthwhile. Where Bitcoin, it's like, all right, it's working. Let's just tighten it up and tighten the rules as much as possible to make it as efficient as possible, at least from an outsider's perspective looking at, a non-developer's perspective looking in, that's what it seems like. And how would you describe this sort of philosophy of approaching Bitcoin and working on Bitcoin in particular?
So, I mean, I don't want to speak for everybody else in the Bitcoin community. So this is my view of it, right? You know, I like to deal with, you know, most of the things that I did, you know, before I learned computer science was basically messing with Linux systems, right? And from all of that, I have learned how, you know, fragile security is, right? Like, you can have perfectly fine code bases. You can have the most secure code base or whatever, you know, that's like completely proven and whatever. And if, you know, something in the hardware fails or something lower in the stack fails, you don't have protections against that, right? So I think that if people want to be realistic about, I mean, right, it's sort of like people have to be realistic about what their coin is about, right? If your coin is about making money really fast, then go ahead and do that, right? But if your coin is actually trying to be something that, you know, lasts, that is going to be maybe part of human history, who knows, you know, then you have to be extremely conservative about these things, because, you know, people lose trust very easily, and you know, you've got all these bugs already at a layer below your code base. You know, you've got to make sure that your thing is okay. And we try to fix the lower level bugs as well, as you know, I presented on last time, which is the, you know, our build system stuff, making reproducible and bootstrappable builds.
Yeah, so let's jump right into that. So for you freaks who weren't at BitDevs last month, it was last month's BitDevs, right? Yeah, I think so. Carl gave a great presentation based on your pull request that you have out there right now, enable building in GUIX containers for Bitcoin. And basically, the concept is that a lot of sort of, like you were describing, repositories sort of at the root of a lot of operating systems are very intertwined and sometimes come with bad code and bugs that can, if your hardware gets compromised, people can get access to your kernel and basically wreck your machine. And it's trying to sort of isolate and sort of separate these containers so that you know that they're separate and clean.
I think, like, it's better explained if I explain the history, right? So
yes.
So the history of all of this is, I think, Bitcoin got reproducible builds through this tool called Gideon in 0.4, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Gideon was, I think, revolutionary for its time, because, you know, it enabled the conversion of, you know, source code that we can read to, you know, binary outputs, right? You know, the code that, you know, your machine reads, right? You obviously can't open an app in a text file, in a text editor or whatever, right? It enabled that conversion, the compilation and the build tool chain, to be deterministic in that, you know, given the same code, it will output the same output. And, you know, so what that enabled is for us to detect when somebody is not giving you the binary output that you think they are, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, if you ask a friend, like, hey, do you have a Bitcoin binary? Like, they give you a binary, right? You can verify that it actually came from the source code that's on the repo or from a version that you trust, instead of they just modified it to upload your private key,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that was, you know, that was the first iteration of it. But the process relied on Ubuntu, as in, like, it was done in an Ubuntu virtual machine. And the first thing that it does is it spins up a Ubuntu virtual machine, and then it downloads all these trusted binary packages, right? So it downloads, like, GCC. GCC is, like, the compiler that people use to compile their C, C++, and code other languages as well sometimes. And those are just binaries that we trust the, you know, Ubuntu developers to be like, hey, you know, I sign off on this or whatever, right? And, you know, to me, that seemed a little fragile because we're reproducible, but we can also be reproducibly malicious in that, you know, the Ubuntu developer could be like, oh, I want everybody's Bitcoins. I'm going to sign off on this version of GCC where if it sees that I'm compiling the Bitcoin code base, I'm going to insert, you know, the password sealing, whatever, in it, right? So, you know, maybe I'm too paranoid about these stuff, but to me,
I don't think so.
but to me, that didn't seem like a good thing. And also the whole build process was extremely complicated. And well, at the time when I was running it, it only worked on like a very limited variety of Linux distributions, which means there's less diversity. So I went about trying to solve this, and the way that you solve this is to basically boil down, sort of make the number of trusted binaries smaller, right? And the way you have to do that is, okay, let's say that we have like, you know, these like 100 build dependencies that are trusted binaries. We have to have some sort of way to have maybe, let's say, 10 trusted binaries and record the route of how we get from these 10 to these 100, right? And this is sort of a problem that hasn't really been looked at, because every time somebody compiles a compiler, you know, they're just using the last version of the compiler. They're not like thinking about how do we go from nothing to it. They're like, my computer already has a compiler. How do I do that, right? This is actually a problem in Rust, but you know, geeks is a great way to solve it. So geeks is what we call a functional package manager.
Yeah, GUIX for you freaks.
Yes,
out there.
GUIX, but it's pronounced geeks. I it was very confusing for me as well. But what it is that every package, and this is the important part, every package is a pure function of its build time dependencies and runtime dependencies, right? So that means that nothing else affects it, right? So what you're able to do is you're able to look at these, let's say, 100 trusted binaries that you need, like you need GCC, bin utils, FD, whatever, right? And you can trace it all the way back to, you know, to maybe 10 trusted binaries, maybe even less, right? And they have ongoing efforts to make the list of trusted binaries less and less. And they were basically the first ones who released a solution to bootstrap Rust, because Rust has had such a long chain. Rust C, the compiler, has such a long chain of being built that it was hard to do, but they did it, and so we now have somewhat bootstrappable builds if we do it with these geeks containers, and I think that will improve security a lot. Also, it doesn't care about what Linux you're what distro you're running. It basically runs on every single Linux distribution.
You know, it was funny during your presentation. You had like a chart that sort of graphically showed like all the bootloaders and like everything
yes.
that becomes connected
yeah.
and how interconnected
yeah.
it becomes and how easy it is to become completely interconnected with a bunch of other systems that can leave you vulnerable, which is crazy to see in like chart form.
I like visual aids. I'm not a big fan of readings and I like visual aids, so I was like, oh, maybe I'll put that up as a slide. But yeah,
it was very helpful.
Yeah.
No, but this is high. Okay. This is, we'll get to your talk over the weekend at MIT eventually, but you brought it up during this talk, but it also highlights the problem that you're trying to solve with the geeks containers is that like all of our operating systems are probably rooted at some level, and maybe Bitcoin is the first instance to create a monetary incentive to exploit these problems.
Right.
And up to this point, like we've had data dumps with like Equifax Target, you name it, any type of entity industry has been hacked.
Yeah.
People don't seem to care. But now that Bitcoin, a digital native digital money, is on the line, maybe these things will be exploited more and more. Is this a good thing, a bad thing?
Oh, I think that's definitely a good thing. I think, you know, if we ignore problems, they become, I mean, this is, you know, you know, everyday life, right? Like if you ignore problems, they're going to get worse and worse until one day you can't even deal with it anymore, right? And I think like, you know, one of my colleagues, Matt had this, Matt Carella had this quote, I think, of like, you know, maybe the current generation don't care about security or is not too sensitive to it. I think like future generations will be. One of the trends that I realized is that I watch a lot of YouTube, and you'll see that like these YouTube channels, they're all advertising, you know, VPN solutions. Most of them are advertising VPN solutions, and it struck me that like, and it's been happening for months, right? So it struck me that like it must be very profitable, as in people are listening to that and actually buying it, and people care about security. Now, whether or not VPN solutions are actually secure for you, because you instead of giving it to your ISP, you're giving information to like the company,
another third party.
Exactly. I mean, like I personally think like Molvat is the only one that like is actually secure, because like it doesn't even record your name. But anyways, but yeah, I think future generations will be more aware of this than us, because they grew up in a world where these hacks are happening, you know, every other month.
Yeah. So I guess what's your biggest fear when it comes to these exploits in relation to Bitcoin? Like, what's the worst case scenario that could happen right now at this point in time? Let's fearmonger a little bit.
I don't. I mean, I think. Yeah, I don't really have a good answer to that, but I think like more the attack is on a social level, basically, right? You know, people use the excuse of, you know, Bitcoin is being used for illegal drugs, or, you know, Bitcoin exchanges get hacked, which have nothing to do with like the actual Bitcoin protocol itself. And again, right, these are problems not of the Bitcoin software. The software is running completely fine. It's how they deploy the software and how they manage their Unix and Linux systems that lead to these
things. The problem.
Sorry?
That's the problem.
Yes. Exactly. System administration and SecOps is an extremely hard problem to solve, and we've sort of made systems that are very easy to use but are also overly complex.
No, but it's fascinating. So you think Bitcoin is more vulnerable in the social layer than the technical layer?
I think so, because it's just easier,
right?
It's just easier to do social attacks, right? Like the thing that I'm talking about of like, you know, when I guess it blurs the line between a social attack and a technical attack. Like when a Ubuntu developer, you know, inserts a bug in GCC or whatever, right? That somebody might blackmail him to do that, right? Like there are things like that that you can do. I think that to look at like consensus critical bugs and whatever, you need a very keen eye, right? You need to understand the entire code base and whatever, and there are much easier way to go about doing this. And if somebody really wants to destroy Bitcoin, they're gonna go the easy way first before.
Yeah. That's a good point. So like finding a bug, like the CVE bug from September, the inflation it was two parts. What was it? Inflation and DDoS bug, right? Mm-hmm. How well do you need to know the code base to sort of even identify that, like at that point? Because wasn't it found by like a Bitcoin Cash member, right? Or
right. I haven't really looked into that bug that much. But I would say that it's a much higher bar than social attacks, right? Like you need to know computer science, you need to know how attacks usually work and how, you know, one might appear in a repository, because, you know, the Bitcoin repository is quite big, and you have to go dig through it and see how everything's structured and everything, right? So
yeah. No, it's fascinating, because a lot of when you're trying to explain this stuff to normies, a lot of the first rebuttal is, oh, I could get hacked one day. Like, what happened? Like, the code just doesn't work. And it's like a hard question to answer. It's like, yeah, well, obviously it would suck if the code didn't work, but like, what are the chances of the code not working one day?
Right. I think maybe this answer isn't very useful now, but I think one day what we'll need is some kind of, you know, formal verification of the mechanisms or something like that. But you know, it's not reasonable to do it now. I don't think so.
No,
because
too early in the game.
Yeah, exactly. It's too early in the game.
How early in the game are we, do you think? We're 10 years in. What, like, how much more do we have to get done to the point where this is close to ossification? When are we going to ossify, Carl? If ever. When's 18.0 coming out? That's another question. Or, excuse
right.
me. 18.0 is testing right now. I want to say 1.0. One's version 1.
One point.
When's version 1 coming out?
Yeah, well, that you'll have to ask, you know, Vladimir about. but I have no timeline for this kind of thing. I
Nor can you put one on it, really, could you?
I really don't know. I think we're super early in the game. I think we've still got a lot to explore. I think, like, cryptography has never been as sexy as it is today.
It's right? Very sexy.
It's very sexy right now, right?
Shout out to the Schnorr patent officially being over with this week.
Exactly. Thank God.
Who would have known that 10 years ago?
Right. There's all sorts of cool things that we can explore, and you know, cryptography I think is it's sort of relatively young, and we have, you know, we have all sorts of strange math, and you know, some of these math, it's like you just have to, it sort of just pops into people's heads, right? Like, so, you know, we've definitely got a long way to go. So I would say we're very, very early.
That's
long timeline of things.
So one step on the road on that long journey that we were talking about before the podcast is Russell Yanofsky's work to separate the wallet GUI from the node. In Bitcoin Core.
Oh, yeah.
So can you explain sort of... what Russ is trying to do and how it helps.
Right. Let's see. Russ's work is more to do with the maturation of the Bitcoin code base, mm-hmm. right? I was mostly talking about, you know, cryptography stuff, which is like, doesn't have that much to do with, you know, the code base structure. I think it's one of the most important, you know, PRs, series of PRs and work out there, because it, Bitcoin basically as of now is a blob of things that are very much intertwined and entangled with each other as a code base, right? Mm-hmm. And we want to be able to make it more modular, right? And so what Russ did was he set up this directory called interfaces, and Russ, if I'm explaining this poorly, please forgive me. But he made
Russ is a long time listener to this podcast, so he's definitely going to hear it.
Oh gosh,
I'm kidding. I have no idea.
Okay, all right. He basically defined these interfaces for the wallet and the GUI to talk to. That isn't sort of the main code itself, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's extremely important in that, you know, one of his largest PRs is called multi-process Bitcoin, as in we can spin up a Bitcoin node and then spin up a wallet process and then spin up a QT process and kill them and do whatever, do the thing that Unix was designed to do, right? You know, do one thing and do it well and do that with a Bitcoin node. And I think that is extremely compelling. And also it's compelling to me in also the sense of the governance of the code base, as in, you know, perhaps the GUI can be governed in a different way from, you know, the wallet can be different governed in a different way from, you know, the core node software. They certainly have different levels of, you know, severity in terms of, you know, security and whatever. And also, you know, you can have people who focus on this module and don't have to worry about other modules.
Interacting with the other ones. Yeah, it seems to make perfect sense. Like, separate and just let people innovate where they need, because it's really holding back people from working on specific functions, correct?
Right, exactly. If you have well-defined interfaces and they're actually separated out, then you can, it's sort of, you know, you can more or less plug and play, is what I would say. Yeah,
no, so shout out to Russ Unosky working on that. Another chain code legend.
Legend.
What's it like in that chain code office?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. I walk in and I'm really intimidated by, like, you know, just like a group of legends who are in the room, right? And like everybody's like really, really experienced in the Bitcoin Core code base, and I've sort of been doing build stuff and a little bit of Bitcoin Core work, but like, you know, I try to ask them for help. I try to learn from them. I try to, you know, because they're just way more experienced than I am. And it's really interesting because, you know, you get to hear them talk about stuff, and, you know, you think to yourself, probably only, you know, a dozen or so people in the world, you know, has the context to be like spewing out like proper pronouns like they are. And like, okay, well, I'll listen and I'll try to learn. Right. Yeah.
And what's it like working with the nicest man in the world, John Newberry?
Oh my gosh. It's such a pleasure. It is actually, I am so impressed by like the amount of things he can accomplish and like how hard he hustles, right? Because like he also works on Bitcoin Optech, which I'm helping out with, but like I also see him, he'll just be like, oh yeah, you know, just like do a 1 day review of like Russ's PRs, and like leave a bunch of notes, and like, oh my gosh, this man is crazy.
Consummate professional, a true gentleman. John.
Yes.
We're due for some old fashions and getting cosmic soon. Just note if you're listening. I guess another topic, well, we're on chain code, like, so this is like a very hot topic in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general is developer incentives. And so how important are like chain codes, the block streams of the world to allowing you to do what you do best?
I mean,
obviously you're biased, you work for chain code, but
I think these institutions are really important in the world that we are in now. Especially for me, you know, I'm not a US citizen. I need like visa sponsorships. Like I have to like work for a company or something like that. Right. But I can foresee a world where, you know, people can crowdfund these things. I think, one of the great things that, you know, Patreon is of course controversial, but I think one of the great things that Patreon has done is like it funds people in sort of a peer-to-peer way. One of the most incredible things that I found out about Patreon is there's this, you know, gamers like to spend their money on games, right? And perhaps this is very telling. There's an emulator for the Wii U. I know, I'm sorry. I like to play Smash, and, you know, the Wii U is...
Who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly, right? Wii U, you know, Smash 4 was, you know, I'm a scrub because I don't play Melee or Project M or whatever. But
get out. We actually don't like scrubs in the studio, so this interview's over.
Yeah. Anyways, there was this Wii U emulator called CEMU, C-E-M-U, and on Patreon, I believe one time I checked, they were getting 20K a month to work on this Wii U emulator. And I was like, that's a full-time job and a little more, you know, like 20K a month is a lot, Right, exactly. And I'm very encouraged by that. And I think that, you know, very soon people will make alternatives to that that perhaps can operate in the Bitcoin world, perhaps can operate in a world where the company is, you know, not liable for, you know, whatever the person does, you know, what the creator is doing. So I think that's going to be very interesting. What we do see is that it is much more, it's still centralized now because it's just nobody has built the tools, right? One of the interesting things was Hardcore Fund. Have you heard of Hardcore Fund? Oh, okay. So like Hardcore Fund is this fund started by this interesting gentleman in China, Kevin. He actually runs like the Lightning Network, like WeChat group that people are in. It's like a crazy number of people who are in it. And he started this fund to be able to give money to people who contribute to Bitcoin Core, which is very interesting. And he did it. And I think on the first day there were like three or four donors. So I was like, oh, okay, this is not going to take off. And then like within a week, there was about like 50 Bitcoins of donations.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I was like, this is
Salary.
Exactly. That's a salary. That's like legitimately, something that you can live off of. And I think we've got, Luke and Ben are two of the, you got to apply for them to donate to you. But like, you know, it's going to be somewhat centralized until somebody builds the tools to do that. Right?
What do you think about projects like Zcash and Decred maybe that have like developer funds built in? Do you think that's...
I don't think it needs to be built in.
No, I agree.
I don't. I think as people who believe in digital currencies, we can be very be enticed by the concept of having things encoded in protocol and this utopia where technology is governs and whatever, right? But that's not how it's going to happen, right? If you think of it as, you know, a product that you want people to adopt, then you gotta do it in like the way that is most similar to the way they currently do it now, and then maybe slowly transition them into you know what you think is going to be the future.
I completely agree. I think, I mean, Bitcoin has proven up to this point they don't need a developer fund like in the protocol. It's amassed some of the smartest minds in the world and kept their attention for at least a lot of their attention for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. And that's like, once you have these, in my opinion, once you have these developer funds built into your protocol, which then dictates that you build in like sort of a social layer via governance to divvy up how that fund works.
Yeah,
like,
there will always be ways to game the system. Exactly. Basically. Right.
Exactly. So. It'll always be exploited no matter how hard you market that it's not exploitable. It is a system that will be exploited by somebody.
Yeah. And you can sort of think of this as like the enforcement of the contract of people contributing to developers are off chain if it's just people to people, right? Because like I make the calculations that I think this developer is what and I think their potential is what, and I donate to them instead of like the system deciding it for you and it being, you know, quote unquote on chain.
Yeah, that's what Chaincode did with you. They said Carl's pretty fucking dope. We want to come have him work on Rust Lite, or excuse me, Rust Bitcoin. Let's have him in.
Yeah, the I gotta admit the imposter syndrome is very real.
Well. You're talking to somebody who has imposter syndrome every time they sit down and interview somebody. So it's the feeling. I know what it's like.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
That was fun. That was fun riffing on chain code. I guess let's jump into your panel talk over the weekend at MIT.
Mm.
I was in my boxers watching it. It was Sunday morning or Saturday morning. I forget.
Mm-hmm.
It was you, Corey Fields. Who was the other gentleman? The British guy? He was a student at MIT, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a student at MIT, and I think he works on Vertcoin. Unfortunately, I forgot his name, but
and
yes.
The moderator, what was her name? She was a...
Shane Goldberg, yes.
Shane Goldberg.
She works at Arwin with Ethan, I think. Yeah.
And so the topic of conversation was responsible disclosures and how they differ between sort of centralized systems and open source systems and sort of the intricacies and the nuance that come with disclosure in distributed open source systems and free and open source software projects. So I guess let's just dive into what is a disclosure and then how does it differ from like a centralized company? The example that the moderator used was Airbnb and then Bitcoin. I guess we can jump
into that. Well, I want to say up front that like I'm not really involved with the security disclosure thing with Bitcoin Core and everything. I think, you know, I haven't gotten there.
Excuse me.
But disclosure is basically, you know, if somebody finds a bug, they want to inform the developers somehow. And, you know, we've seen it done in bad ways where, you know, maybe somebody just announces to the world, I found this bug, right? And perhaps people lose a lot of money or
there was a big kerfuffle breaking Bitcoin a couple of years ago.
I remember that. And you know, there are also the way that you're supposed to do it, which is, you know, inform the developer and not tell anybody until the developer says it's fixed, or you sometimes would. I think what Google Zero does, and Google Zero does a great job, I think a great service to the industry, as evil as you may think Google is, is they find 0 days and they disclose it to the vendor and then give them, I think it's 90 days to either respond or fix it, right? And that 90 days is, I think, very important in that sometimes vendors will just ignore these things, and 90 days puts actually time on the clock for them to actually do it. And I think that there was a recent one that, like, they told Apple about, and Apple just did not
respond.
Right? So they were like, okay, we're lifting the, you know, we're going to tell everybody the details of this now.
Apple's had some pretty bad bugs recently.
The one
where you were able to like just spacebar and get your password or.
Yeah. That to log in as root, I think.
Yes, that's what it was. Yeah.
Not super great. So, you know, And I think the biggest kerfuffle that was quite recent was, you know, the Intel SMT like Spectre meltdown, speculative execution bugs that was disclosed basically to big vendors and big operating systems, but smaller operating systems just didn't get a notice until I think like a week before it was like released to the public, and obviously that just wasn't enough time to fix all these things, right? And so I think security vulnerabilities are disclosure process has to be refined somehow.
Yeah, well, and then in Bitcoin in particular, it's an added layer because again, there's a ton of value in these systems, and so the argument you guys are making on the panel was that in Bitcoin and free and open source software in particular, the sort of the person who's ringing the alarm and disclosing the bug should probably be anonymous for many reasons, one of which being like, imagine if you disclosed the bug and somebody exploited it between when you disclosed it was patched and people are going to point at you first, like, hey, we know that you knew about this, and it puts a lot of undue pressure.
For sure. Yeah. Like, especially when money's involved, it's actually quite like thin ice that you have to walk on. And I think we were also talking about, I don't think we came to a conclusion about this, like if we find something in Bitcoin Core, is it our responsibility to tell and identify and tell all of the coins that are, you know, code forks of Bitcoin Core to fix their stuff? And I don't think we came to a conclusion on that, but you know, maybe there needs to be a chat, like some kind of way or tool or something by which you can post vulnerabilities, and you as a software maintainer can, you know, have a filter on that and be notified of new developments in your dependencies or your code forks.
Yeah. No, but it's crazy because it is a tricky problem, especially like Bitcoin Core does not want to represent Bitcoin like as a whole. So like Bitcoin being this amoebus, unstructured sort of thing. Like,
yeah.
Who do you tell? Like, do we come tell chain code? Do we come tell?
Right.
You make a pull request or like what, in your opinion, what would you do if you discovered a zero day or a bug and had to disclose it? Putting you on the spot.
Oh, dang. Well,
would you spin up an Anon? Would you go make a Proton email account and start?
Yeah, I would go look at, you know, what are some of the developers who have worked on, you know, previous disclosures and how what their PGP keys are, and, you know, anonymously write, you know, do a little write up and, you know, send it over to them and see how it is, you know. And I believe, I'm not completely sure that on bitcoincore.org there's disclosure process and stuff.
You don't believe there is?
Or
there
is? I believe there is. Okay. There's some notice about how to do it correctly.
Yeah. It's like there's so much goddamn surface to take in consideration with this stuff. Like everything.
Yeah. I mean, like one of the things that I was talking about on that panel was how Intel Management Engine has gotten into almost every computer, every server, everything.
What does this mean?
So Intel Management Engine is like, it lives basically on your motherboard, and it basically can override the kernel. So like your kernel might be like OpenBSD or you know, one of those really secure kernels, and it enforces security and whatever.
For all the freaks out there who are completely technically incompetent, what is a kernel? Like, so the kernel is the most important.
An operating system. Yes. An operating system. Right, exactly. So for example, like Linux is a kernel, right? Mac OS has a kernel called Darwin, right? Mm-hmm. So that's supposed to be like the core part of the operating system that you cannot live without, right? And so that's usually what enforces, like, this process, you only have these privileges and can only read and talk to these files. And, you know, that process, you don't even have network access and whatever, right? So the kernel is seen to be sort of, people define these rings differently, but I'll say ring zero, right? Ring zero is like, you know, the zeroth level, mm-hmm. right? Intel Management Engine is basically one below that, as in it doesn't care what the kernel thinks, it can do whatever it wants. And that's very dangerous, especially if you're in a server setting and basically you've just nullified all the security procedures, all the security, the protection that you have from the kernel, which we've coded in, right? And we've also got this complex boot process through this new mechanism. So the way that you boot your computer, right, is that you basically go into UEFI mode first, and then you boot into the computer. And UEFI is a gigantic code base with like a mini kernel inside it with like a networking stack that you rarely update. So that's, again, another vulnerability. And these are things that, you know, we don't really think about, because if you think about them, then
everything's fucked.
Everything, exactly. Everything's fucked. If you think about them, everything's fucked. Right?
Is everything fucked, Carl?
I believe so. Yes, I completely agree that everything's fucked. I mean, but we see efforts to fix this, right? And it's very encouraging that, you know, this. I think a lot of people, when they think about like computer security and whatever, they're just like, let's just give up. Like, let's just. Whatever, man. But it's encouraging that there are companies who move forward with this. It's a computer manufacturer called Raptor Engineering. Mm-hmm. They make computers which are completely open source. Like the entire, like all the firmware for all the chips and everything are open source. You can modify them, you can compile them, they have the tool chain to allow you to do all of this, right? So that is, I hope, where the future is going to be. And that allows us to have actual sovereignty over our hardware and be able to control our future.
Yeah. So is it more of a problem of motivation as a problem of like a...
It's an economic problem.
Yeah.
It's an economic problem, right? Because people don't see it as
necessary.
Exactly. People don't see it as necessary, and there hasn't been too much economic loss. So, you know, we're not going to pay for the more expensive Raptor motherboard. We're just going to stick with the manufacturer we know, which is Intel, and then continue with that.
Yeah, but it seems like if... So the solution sounds like just open source the hardware, the firmware, and the software of your open operating system.
And you know, this is one of the encouraging things about, you know, mankind is that we are very good at making things cheaper and more efficient, right? And, you know, as we were able to make things cheaper and more efficient, you have small companies like Raptor Engineering building their own motherboard, right? Like, if, you know, a few decades ago, like, you know, you had to be one of the biggest companies out there to be able to like design the components and make it all open source and whatever. But, you know, because we have this infrastructure set up, it's easier to be more free. And I like that technology enables that in a way. Yeah,
technology enables that. Technology is getting cheaper and cheaper. Other things are not, like education, healthcare, and cars and stuff like that. But that's a big topic. We jump into economic shit a lot in this podcast. Mm. We've done that a lot lately. I'm happy that we're having a technical episode today because we haven't jumped into like tech in a while here on Tales from the Crypt. I mean, we obviously talk about Bitcoin, which is tech, but like,
oh yeah,
this conversation like this has not happened in a while on this podcast. So I'm happy it's happening tonight.
Great.
But yeah, no, it's interesting. Like, like you said, it's an economics problem. So like Bitcoin, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, like having so much value, maybe
it shifts the equation a little bit.
Right. It shifts the incentives.
Yeah. It shifts the incentives and shifts the equation a little bit. I think like, you know, what might end up happening is that we will have better and better hardware wallets. I think hardware wallets right now are still not extremely well designed, but you know.
Just jump into it. I mean, over the weekend, Ledger came at Trezor pretty hard. What's your beef with hardware wallets right now?
I don't have a particular beef with hardware wallets. I think they're just not... I know that some of them don't actually do what they're supposed to. Like, I think they don't authenticate procedure calls to their secure enclave. I might be completely wrong, but I think some of them don't actually do that. And so basically, if you know how to open the device and know how to like talk to the chip, then like you basically can get it to sign anything that you want it to sign. Which you know is not hardware security, but of course it's better than keeping it on an online computer.
Right.
You know, not saying that that's not. And also, I think one of the other things is that, and I think as programmers, we tend to think too much about the technical stuff and not enough about the social and economic stuff. It's like, my mom doesn't want to use a hardware wallet.
No.
Like, yeah. That's just too... Because I thought about it, right? Like, I was like, okay, what would I do to have, enough of a secure setup for my keys that I feel comfortable with, right? Okay, maybe I get security deposit boxes, and then I maybe like Shamir secret share my like mnemonics to these deposit boxes, and then like get a few ledgers and then get them in there. Like, nobody's doing that. I'm not doing that. Nobody's gonna learn to do that. And so it's great that we have multisig that's not broken.
What do you mean by that? Was that
a
shot at Ethereum right there?
Yeah, I think Parity had a broken multisig contract.
Yeah, multiple
or something. Yeah. anyways, yeah, we have multisig that's not broken, and you know, we, that allows companies like, you know, when I was back at Blockstream, like Green Address had this cool thing where it was a multisig with them, right? And I think Casa is doing a cool thing with multisig with them, and like those kind of solutions make a lot of sense to me,
right?
Being able to, you know, recover your keys, and also they don't have custodial access to any of your funds. That's fantastic.
Yeah, no,
it's the right way to go about doing it, I think.
It really is, and I think multisig in particular just needs to become more prevalent. Just like the thought of holding your shit on one key and custodying that yourself is so... It's overwhelming. It's overwhelming for some.
And it's about the user experience. I after... for the first few years of college, I was actually a UI UX designer as a freelancer for companies, right? And it's kind of weird how, like, you know, that's so far removed from what Bitcoin is. But you know, when I look at these things, you need people building good user experiences, and I think like that's what Casa is doing.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
No, I would agree. And slowly but surely, it's happening. People are like, oh, Bitcoin's failed. Bitcoin's died so many times, but it's succeeding through death, I would argue. And do you think, like, looking back and to when you first got into Bitcoin to where it is now, like, are you surprised at how far it's come or disappointed how not far it has gone up to this point? Or is it sort of right in line with your expectations? Do you not have expectations?
Are
you just along for the ride?
I think it's quite surprising how far it's gone. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite surprising how far it's gone. I you know, I was expecting it to just be like, oh, I'll just mine some stuff, you know, get some money, build myself a few new more servers and be happy, you know. But it's gotten a lot of traction. It's got a developer community. It's got, you know, people who really care about it and want to try to understand it, right? I think one of the most impressive presentations at MIT was what was her name? Crypto Mom, Bitcoin Mom, Hester Pierce. And it seemed like her stance was basically that, like, you know, as a regulator, she wants to make sure that she's not imposing rules, because rules will, you know, get passed down, right? That limits innovation, right? So she wants people to tell her, you know, what they're working on and what's going on. And I think that, like, I think years ago, I would never thought that would be possible, that they would even be aware of this, you know, weird internet, magic internet money thing. Yeah.
Let alone not shutting it down.
No, exactly. Let alone not shutting it down.
Well, not that they could shut it down, not trying to shut it down, but instead trying to be as laissez-faire as possible, which is
right.
Which is hard to find in America these days. I'm excited to see that that they're taking a tempered stance on Bitcoin up to this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What else did you like at the MIT thing over the weekend? Wallets got hacked.
Oh boy. There was this one talk by a Gotenna guy.
Oh, Richard Myers?
Yeah, I think so. And he was talking about how you can use Lightning Network payments to incentivize people to run their own Gotennas.
Mm-hmm.
And... like, this is one of those things where, like, it hones in on the point that, like, as technology progresses, things get cheaper to make. Like, you can be your own based, like, very low bandwidth, albeit, like, very low bandwidth ISP with this kind of stuff, right?
Right.
And we can be more decentralized and have access to it that the ISP can't shut down.
Yeah, so what's the gist of it is, if you have a Gotenna that is with TX10 downloaded on it, you are going to get Lightning fees in the form of Lightning Network transactions for routing payments via TX10, or?
I'm not entirely sure, but I think, like, the whole point was just that you can incentivize people to run these relay stations for Gotennas.
Mm-hmm.
Through Lightning, right? It doesn't really need to have anything to do with Bitcoin. It's just using Lightning as a payment way to get people to run these things.
Right.
Right. And that's very important that people can form, a mesh network of themselves, because, you know, God knows what ISPs are doing with our data.
Right? Yeah. So let's get cosmic here. Do you ever envision a future where ISPs aren't the main routers of Bitcoin transactions? Maybe it's via radio waves or mesh networks or satellite.
Eventually that will happen. Eventually I'm sure that will happen. Mm-hmm. But the technology isn't there now.
No,
and
it's definitely
we
not
need
there
to
now.
We need to, you know, we need to fund technological progress, right?
Yeah.
No,
that's one thing I'm so I write about that Marty's been a lot is alternative transaction relay networks, like the mesh network, the satellite, that shit. That's what fascinates me the most, just thinking that you can, via radio waves, send a transaction in space and have it received by somebody with a satellite looking for it. It just blows my mind. And that's the other thing. It helps open people up to the possibilities that this technology enables. Everybody's so sort of siloed in this way of thinking of how the internet works and how it should work and how it has to work. And mm-hmm. Bitcoin, not alone, but Bitcoin definitely is helping people sort of see, hey, maybe we don't have to do things this way. Maybe we can use ham radios to send messages and stuff like that. Maybe we don't need to rely on Comcast or other internet service providers, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think at one point I was looking, and I don't remember fully. I was looking into if I can buy an FM radio band such that I can broadcast blocks, and I was really expensive. I was like, okay, never mind, never mind. But yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, we're gonna. Do you think Bitcoin will ever go to space? Do you think we'll have interplanetary nodes at some point?
Oh boy! I mean,
we're gonna have to increase the block time, right?
Yeah, I would think so, and I think Peter Todd gave a great talk about that, yes. Wasn't it at one of the breaking Bitcoins?
I think he wants to start mining asteroids and putting nodes in space and stuff like that.
I don't think proof of work is. Well, I mean, there's no better alternative, but the current way that Bitcoin is structured is good at dealing with that, and I think we'll solve that problem when we come to it.
Yeah, we're gonna get Dyson spheres. We're gonna go find another star.
Exactly. Dyson. That's one of my biggest hopes, is that we can become like a Type 2 civilization.
What's that mean?
I might be wrong, but I think Type 1 civilization is a civilization that can capture and utilize the all the energy that the planet can provide, right? Type 2 is of the solar system, and Type 3 is of the galaxy, and then so on and so on. So I would hope that someday we can actually build that Dyson sphere and capture it, because that's free real estate.
It'd be crazy too.
Yeah, it's free energy. Yeah.
But we do. All right, let's keep getting cosmic. It's weird. We do have this opportunity, go to space and explore it and fucking.
Yeah, I remember reading when I was in high school. This I didn't read the paper, but I watched. I think it was a Vsauce or something else, where these Russian scientists did a conservative estimation of what how human society will progress, and they came to the conclusion that we will never leave our solar system, and that made me really depressed for a week. I was that's so sad. I mean, it's mankind. I would hope that our future involves traveling around in space and all that.
Everything's really far away though. How to get there. Oh, where's it gonna go? I had something to bring up. This always happens. Got too cosmic. You're talking about Bitcoin in space.
Mm-hmm.
I completely forgot what I was gonna say.
No, don't worry about
it. I was gonna bring it back to something. What were we talking about right before that?
We can talk about Rust Bitcoin for a while.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about Rust Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So Rust Bitcoin is sort of alien to me. I know that Matt works on it. Matt's right. Like, whenever I see Matt, he's like, yeah, working on Rust Bitcoin.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What the hell is Rust? It's just a different implementation, a different language. And
It's not a full node implementation, okay. Right? It's just an implementation of like some of the it's a library, which means just like a collection of tools that you can do. For example, you can derive keys from mnemonics and all of those like little tool things, right? And I think the thought behind it is that at least my thought behind it is that we've written software in sort of not memory safe languages like C and C++, and mm-hmm. The reason why we want to do that is because you have a finer grain control over how the program executes. You're basically you're speaking to the machine in a way such that there's not many layers of translation in there, mm-hmm. right? But what Rust says is we can be a systems language and be memory safe at the same time, right? Which is very compelling because most bugs, most security vulnerabilities are memory bugs.
Okay.
Buffer overflows and double freeze, all of those are memory bugs, right? And Rust says the way that our language is constructed means that you literally cannot have those errors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you see a big movement in the software developer industry, I think, towards people, and maybe this is for the better or worse, but people rewriting programs in Rust because now you have this thing where you don't give up your performance, you don't give up your granularity, but you get memory safety, right? You don't have to worry about that anymore. The compiler will yell at you if you're doing something memory unsafe. And so I think, being able to interact with Bitcoin in a language like that is quite important.
It seems like a pretty good level up if you're able to have that
trade-off. Yes, yes, right. And I'm in no illusion that we're going to have Bitcoin Core and Rust in like a year. Like that's not going to happen, right? But I think it's a good thing to build in parallel. I think one of the great things about what Rust is doing and what I hope to do is that if we can get Bitcoin to be more modular, then perhaps you can write the QT module in Rust. You can mm-hmm. write you can write certain parts of it and basically make it plug and play, right? And perhaps you want to try out this different Neutrino Plus or whatever, right? Like you've got this new thing, right? Oh, okay. Like just use it as a module, use it as a plugin, like whatever, right? I think that's why it's important. And we see things in the Rust Bitcoin project that I think is very encouraging. One of the developers, Tomas Blummer, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name. He's been working on a almost full node. I think it actually works as a full node. That also supports Neutrino, and Ooh. he's finished that, and I need to do a few more code review. I'm sorry, Tomas. And that's super exciting because that's something that we can run, and I hopefully we can test against Bitcoin Core and see how it works. And also, Matt's Rust Lightning is extremely important. I know that Matt's very focused on
BetterHash at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and that's the fantastic work, right? But he's also, he's a I don't want to speak for him, but I think he's a Linux and systems geek like I am. And like he leaves a server on running what we call a fuzzer, and a fuzzer will basically like give your program inputs until it sees that it fails, right? And it will identify where it failed. So all the time he's running that, and he's actually finding problems with his implementation and sometimes with the spec and sometimes with other implementations through running this fuzzer. And yeah, he, good guy.
Yeah. Matt's on the scoreboard as most appearances on Tales from the Crypt. But he's like the one who like first person who started talking about like Rust, Bitcoin and stuff to me. And still to this day, I've always seen like Rust is like so foreign to me. Like to me, it's like, you have to be sort of a badass developer to work with Rust. Is this true? Or
no,
is it just
no.
Like...
Well, to me, actually, like, I, and this is somewhat shameful. I know more Rust than I know C++.
I know.
I'm terrible. But it's one of those languages that, because it's more modern, it's easier to work with. It doesn't have sort of the baggage of C++, and C++ sometimes has the baggage of C and all of that, and maintaining compatibility and whatever. It's able to envision its own world, right, and learn from the languages that have come since. Mm-hmm. So I would say, like, for beginners, Rust is maybe easier to start off with than C++, because of some of the conventions, and like C++ has like implicit conversions that like nobody really understands every single corner case of. But
No, it's fascinating. And as a tech illiterate, it's always fascinating to hear the stuff explained from the mouth of somebody who knows exactly what they're talking about, has been through
somewhat
the trenches.
Somewhat.
But you mentioned Neutrino. Let's go back to Neutrino. So BTCD, they implemented a full node with Neutrino, correct?
That's right.
A lot of contention around Neutrino in particular. A lot of people don't like it.
Right.
Could you give the freaks out there sort of a 30-second reason why people wouldn't like it, or what it does, and then why some people don't like it and why some people do?
I haven't been exploring it that much, but I, you know, it's just a better way to serve light clients, right?
Yes.
And I think it's much better than the SPV model that we have right now. So to be honest, I don't know that much about it. I think the point that I want to make is that, like modularity is important for governance reasons. It's not just because, like, you know, we're really anal developers and we like our things clean, right? Like modularity is great for that, because you can swap things out with one another, right? You can test different things, right? Mm-hmm. Without having to be like, oh, like there's like contention on this pull request or whatever, right? And it enables more freedom, basically, right? Because you can choose what modules you want to run, you can choose what plugins you want to run. And so that's why I think it's important. And BTCD obviously has had Neutrino for a while, because, you know, it's Lalu's little baby, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And I like seeing that, you know, implementations are competing. And I think one of the things that we need to be very aware of is that these node implementations need to remain, which is why I haven't really thought about like doing a full node myself, at least, you know, within these few years, is that full node implementations need to be consensus compatible with each other,
right?
And the easiest way to be absolutely consensus compatible is to have the exact same code base,
right?
These implementations need to be wary of that, as in you don't want to cause a network split between one implementation and another one, right?
Isn't this something that Satoshi warned about, or how?
Yeah, I mean, I'm betting.
It's the ongoing.
They've said many things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the ongoing debate, though. It's like, should we have multiple implementations? Yeah. Like, is Bitcoin Core centralizing? Is it running everything? And
Here's what I'd say, right? I think that, and this is somewhat speculation. I think that what will happen is that we will be able to split Bitcoin Core in a way such that we have a sort of modular thing that just has the consensus rules and maybe a network implementation that everybody can agree on, right? Mm-hmm. So the network protocol that is sort of standard right now. And so when we can have that, then other implementations like BTCD, which is written in Go, or something that we write for Rust Bitcoin, we can do what's called a FFI, foreign function interface. So that means like the interacting between different languages, mm-hmm. between our thing and that, right? And so now for the consensus critical and the network split critical part, we're all running the same code, but for everything else, it's completely, you know, it's completely up to you how you want to implement it and
what you're comfortable working with.
Exactly. So I think that is the direction that we will go with, but you know, somebody has to do the work, and it's a lot of work. I know there's this project started a long time ago called LibConsensus.
Mm-hmm.
LibConsensus was trying to extract out the core parts of Bitcoin consensus into a library. Oh man, that has burned a lot of people out.
Like, really?
Many have tackled it, but many have, like, you know,
come out
fallen.
Beaten.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, like, it's sort of like, you know, we'll pass it on generation to generation, and one day somebody will be like, hurrah, we got this working, and yeah, we'll have more diversity then.
As somebody who's been working on Bitcoin for a while now, like, what are your thoughts on the attention to the code base in particular? Are you finding more people becoming involved with Bitcoin Core?
Oh, yeah.
Are you finding like smarter minds being attracted to it? Like, as a developer, what are you seeing in the comments and the pull requests and stuff like that? Are you seeing new faces, new anons, or?
Yes. I mean, of course, you're going to have, you know, the few developers who are like always on it, all the time. Like, you know, a lot of my A lot of my colleagues are that way, right? But I've code reviewed things from people who've never contributed before, and they're insightful ones, right? And there are ones from people who perhaps don't really know Bitcoin itself, but know maybe C++ very well, you know, people who know how to structure code very well. There's all kinds of different contributors to Bitcoin Core, and it's very exciting to see that is the case. It also happens in Rust Bitcoin as well. And one of the interesting things about Rust is that it attracts, like, this is so nerdy to say, but as programmers, I think a large section of programmers really love when a language is sexy, and Rust is one of those languages that's really sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll have people who, like, I think that there's like this one, like, one guy who's just like, he really loves Rust and like just stumbled across his library and just like wanted to contribute, right? Like, when I first started out with Rust Bitcoin, I was like trying to write like a bunch of things in Rust, and it wasn't working. And I was like, oh, okay, I know Polster's working on this. Let me learn Rust through. And you know, I didn't tell him at the time that this was like my first Rust thing, but you know, I learned through all of his comments about how horrible it was. And then, you know, and that was the tweet that I made, which is like, you know, through like 7 months of grinding, we got, you know, like partially signed Bitcoin transactions into Rust Bitcoin. That was through a lot of refinement and also a lot of looking at, you know, what were problems in the code base that we needed to solve before this got merged in. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's Thank you for doing what you're doing. I can't, like, because it fascinates me. Somebody, yeah. I mean, obviously you're getting paid for your work, but just looking at a project, a mission-driven project like Bitcoin that
I can't
hire anybody. It just has to attract talent.
I think it kind of comes back to my love of, and maybe I've heard about a few things that do what Patreon is doing and the Bitcoin, like Tippin.me is one of those.
Tally.coin.
Right, Tally.coin and all those things.
You can white label all that stuff for finding too, which is...
Sorry?
You can... I think a little hint here for the freaks out, you can white label that. It might be white labeled for like personal sites in the future.
Right. Well, yeah.
Because all you need is BTC pay server. That's really all you need.
Right. But I'm thinking even, maybe this is impossible. It is if there is a way, because people don't want to, as much as we would like to think so, people don't want to run their own servers. People don't want to maintain their own servers. You're never going to have the expertise of somebody like Amazon or Google managing your servers by yourself, right? So if there is a way to be able to run software like that in a way that is somewhat decentralized and can't be shut down, and you don't have the liability if somebody is doing something on there that people would disagree with, that would be fantastic. Maybe, you know, a model to look at is perhaps, you know, what Mastodon is doing with the federated stuff, but yeah. I haven't looked too much into that.
Mastodon is, yeah, it's an animal. I mean, Mastodon is legitimately an animal, like the app that they built is an animal.
Yeah, I heard it was really popular in Japan or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was really popular on Bitcoin Twitter like 6 months ago when they got mad at Twitter. And we all ported over to Mastodon for 2 days and then came back. We're like, it's too crazy over there. There's not enough people.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, these UX problems will solve themselves over time. But, you know, I think, you know, we still need people working on that.
Yeah. Well, we're almost an hour and a half in. I guess we should end it like the next 10, 20 minutes. And
cool.
What are you most excited for moving forward? Obviously, you're working on Rust Bitcoin and with the geek stuff as well. But just like beyond what you're working on, like what, like how are you feeling right now? Like depths of the bear market. Where are your vibes? Where do you think we're going? What excites you? What worries you as we move forward?
I think I'm pretty chill about like the bear market and whatever.
You seem pretty chill.
Yeah, like my dad always freaks out. You know, like you get text messages like, "Oh, well, Bitcoin went up or Bitcoin went down," and I was like, "This is not very interesting to me." I think we've been trained to think too short term.
Right,
you know,
high time preference.
Right, that's what that is, and I think we need to think long term, and my thinking has always been like, you know, like whatever T to infinity, or you know, in a few decades or in a few centuries, like what kind of society will we live in, and what is it going to be driven by, right? And I think it's going to be driven by something like Bitcoin, and that, you know, that's why I want to work on something like this.
No, I concur. That's why we have the podcast. That's why I brought you on.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on, man. I think, again, like I said, we haven't gotten very technical on this podcast in a while, and I learned a lot today. I learned that Rust is a new language. I thought it was like some old language that nobody wanted to touch.
It's like...
It sounds old. Rust. Rust just makes it sound
old. Right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. No, it's pretty new and it's pretty cool. I'd recommend people who are more technically inclined to check it out and learn it.
Yeah. And then also check out your PR for the Geeks Containers as well.
Oh, yes. If people know about build systems and GCC and libtool and all of that, please come help me. Just search GUIX in the Bitcoin repo pull requests.
Yeah. And Chain Code, they got a residency coming up. If you were,
oh, I'm so excited about that. That's,
we'll talk about it a little bit.
That's one of the so we got so many applicants. Like our I don't know if I'm allowed to reveal exactly how many, but like we've got a we've had to, you know, let a lot of people, just tell a lot of people that they can't come. But the group of people that will be in the office for the summer, I am so excited about. They know exactly what they're doing. They are excited to work on Bitcoin stuff. They will be, I think, a big part of Bitcoin development of tomorrow and years to come. Yeah.
I can't wait till they're in town all summer, so I can just poach most of them for interviews.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'll be.
This is one person.
You're gonna see. I'm gonna come into the Chain Code office and grab one a week and just be like, "All right, what the hell are you working on right now?"
Exactly,
Carl.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure, man.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for coming around. Thanks for coming through. Excuse me. Thank you for all you do on Bitcoin Core, and thanks for educating us tonight about many things.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's cool. All I got for tonight. This is my second podcast. I'm a little burnt out right now.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoyed drinking beers with you.
Peace. Go get some rest.
Yeah. Peace and love, freaks.